I'm kind of sick.
Me too.
Just so you know.
Yeah, me too.
I took.
I'm serious.
Yeah, I took today off from. Well, there you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, and dying of some epizootic is Richard Wally.
And you're Cassidy Robinson from some Ebola coming out your eyeballs thing from California.
This is the sick cast.
This is. We're going to talk about our illnesses and our woes.
Apparently, somehow, even though we are separated by thousands of miles, we've both contracted something over the last few days. Yeah.
Some unknown plague.
So, I personally am a little feverish and definitely zapped of energy. So if I fall asleep while you're talking, that's why.
I think that was the last couple days for me. I'm more into the into the throat stuff.
I'm just going to take that line from the podcast and put it as a meme on your face online. I'm more into the throat stuff.
It's true.
Richard Wally, Jabber and the Drone. So what do you think you caught it from? What did you do over the weekend?
Oh, I know. I know who gave it to me.
Your wife?
No. No, it was a friend of ours. She was sniffly, and I got it.
Mm. Well, you should probably...
Not an exciting story, I'm sorry.
You should probably quit licking her eyeballs.
That's gross. You're being gross.
I know about those Portland eyeball-licking parties.
That could be a thing.
Where you drink that weird...
You know, probably mostly happens under the steel bridge at night, but...
Right. You drink that weird tea that makes you throw up, and then you have a weird trip, and then you lick each other's eyeballs.
The thing is, keep Portland weird, but having a conversation this week with some friends, like, every city is weird. We're telling weird stories from other places.
Oh, yeah. LA is plenty weird. And, yeah. And everybody who's from here will tell you how weird it can get. Just go to Hollywood Boulevard and hang out for an hour or two.
That's fair. That's why it's kind of like, okay, whatever.
Talk to some of those weird homeless people dressed as superheroes who are probably paranoid schizophrenic or something.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have those too. So, I mean, it's just like, yeah, it's a city. Our friend kept telling his story about being in this Italian restaurant. And, like, there were these giant murals, like, you know, like wall-sized murals of boobies and penises, and there was just techno music playing, and it was like this really nice fancy like Italian restaurant, and then he'd look across and there's like these old ladies with like these like the bonnet haircuts eating.
Right. Yeah. Are you sure he wasn't invited to like a vampire's den? Because it sounds like he was invited to a vampire's den.
Well, it's New York. It could be. You never know. There's a lot of there's a lot of types over there.
Some vampire speakeasy.
Yeah.
Which is the name of my new rockabilly band, by the way.
Vampire Speakeasy. That's actually a really good one.
It is still Halloween month.
We do that.
Do you want to inform our listeners? Where are you on your horror movie watching? Have you kept up with yourself?
Oh, easy. Easy peasy, yeah.
Anything you've watched this year that you haven't seen before?
No, I've been doing a lot of nostalgia watching.
Okay.
I made it through the Nightmare on Elm Street series.
Okay.
The Phantasm series, which if you haven't seen the first Phantasm,
I've actually never seen any of the Phantasm movies.
Watch the first one for sure, but then I really enjoy the next. I mean, they're campy fun, the next few, but they're pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Motel Hell, that's a lot of fun. You should do that if you haven't seen it.
I've heard about it, yes.
Part of our movie buying. Did I already say we watched Friday the 13th? We've been watching that series.
Oh, no, well. You didn't say that.
Yeah, yeah, we're getting through that one as well. We just got done with, before we started the podcast, with Jason Takes Manhattan.
Right. That's right there in the middle.
I think it's 9, actually. So I still got 4 more.
Right. And do you count the remake as well?
We're going to watch the remake as well, yeah. Okay. We got the, like, box set thing that came with everything.
There you go.
So, yeah. The first three are about the same movie.
Yeah.
The fourth one's not bad. The fourth, fifth, and maybe sixth, seventh aren't bad. And then this Manhattan one has probably been really, really... I mean, they're all bad. Let's be honest.
Yeah, none of them are good movies.
But what I mean is those ones are more entertaining and have a little bit more redeeming qualities. This last one, I mean, they're all... We make fun of all of them, but this last one was really a doozy.
I think really Jason nasty. Takes Manhattan might have been the first Friday the 13th I ever saw. And I haven't seen that many. I would say of the whole series, I've seen maybe 2 or 3 of them. I don't even really remember.
Rewatching them?
Yeah.
I never watched them in order. Not once.
Right.
And so I had no idea, like, which ones came. And so it's been interesting seeing it just, like, in the order they came out. I was like, oh, that makes more sense. Yeah. The one with there's two specifically that are pretty good. I like it when he becomes... It gets better when he becomes, like, an undead creature versus, you know...
Stalker in the woods.
Yeah. There's specifically one versus him versus a girl with carry powers, and that one's pretty delightful.
Oh, my. Which one is that?
I want to say 7. I could be wrong, though. I could be wrong. There's a lot of those.
All right. I've been enjoying the repertory cinema of lately.
Mm-hmm.
On Friday night, maybe this is why I'm sick, I was up till 3 a.m. at the New Art watching a midnight screening of Showgirls. This is the 25th anniversary, I want to say. 20th. 20.
Well, that's why your tummy is not well. It's because you watched Showgirls.
You know, and I was expecting that to really be packed, right? Because it's like this camp classic and, you know, it has lots of different kinds of audiences. And it's a midnight movie. So I thought it was going to be like packed. So I drive over there because it's kind of close to where I work, the New Art. And I get my ticket real fast at 6 o'clock so I don't have to worry about it later. And I get there about an hour early expecting there to be a line. Mm-hmm. And there was maybe like 3 people waiting outside of the theater. So I just went and hung out at Cinephile Video, which is right next door, for like an hour before I walked over there and just pretty much walked into the movie. I would say there's probably about 60, 70 people there, ultimately, in a theater that seats maybe something like 150, 200.
Hmm.
But it was fun, and that movie's bizarre, and it's such a head-scratcher. You just sit there wondering who the hell was making the final decisions on all of this stuff, and what's intentional and what isn't. And
a fine drug called cocaine.
Yeah.
That's who was making those decisions, my friend.
I don't know. It's crazy. You say what you want about the movie, as far as the content goes. It's actually really well shot and lit, and the cinematography, like, has all of these kind of complicating tracking shots and, you know, who it decides to put in the frame and take out of the frame and how it does that. And, like, technically the movie is, you know, almost immaculate. It's just something about the screenplay and the performances and the way it comes together, which my theory is that it's definitely the movie it wanted to be. I just don't know if that was the movie everyone thought they were getting, including the people in it.
Okay. I rewatched it because you told me to, and it was still just really bad.
But it was at least fun bad, right?
Yeah, it was still fun bad.
Yeah, but, I mean, some of those lines are just hysterical.
Well, there's this thing where she just becomes a, like, karate movie, like, near the end, and that gets a little weird.
And then the next day, me and a friend went to the New Beverly to go see, not a midnight show, it was a 7 o'clock show of Cruising, the William Friedkin movie with Al Pacino. I think we reviewed that actually on the podcast a long time ago.
We did. It was like
as a Netflix thing. Yeah, I don't know. It might not be in the archives anymore. But that's another really bizarre movie.
I did watch Friday. Speaking about cruising, I watched Nightmare on Elm Street 2.
Oh yeah,
I still liked it.
Yeah, I mean it's Nightmare on Elm Street 2 is like one of the strangest of the entire series because A, it's the only one that seems really out of canon.
Mm-hmm.
Like it has nothing to do with the others, and they change Freddy's rules like completely. He goes from being a dream demon to like turning into like a kid turns into a were Freddy.
Yeah.
Not to mention
all the like weird, you know.
Right. Yeah.
It's
the gayest movie of all time.
Yeah, that's better. Right. When you say it.
Yeah, even more so than Cruising.
Yes.
that
shower scene.
Yeah. And I mean, so many things.
There's a lot of things.
So yeah. Many things. I'm read an article or two about it. They're out there.
I still, you know, I liked it when I was young. I still enjoyed it.
Well, it's also I would say the most 80s of all of them. Like they're all made in the 80s and they all have that aesthetic, but that one definitely feels like, I don't know, like a slightly horror-tinged version of a Bronski Beat music video.
You might not be wrong. Well, I will say, though, I did think there might be a Blu-ray effect on some films.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I watch them on Blu-ray and they're, like, really cleaned up and, like, color correction and everything, some of these movies, I think, come across better. It's kind of weird.
Well, whenever anything's shot on film and then, like, you know, they optimize it for Blu-ray and you have a good TV and it's on the right settings and all that stuff, you can make a lot of these old movies look good. Even, like, cheap, you know, movies from the 70s, you can make them look pretty good.
The Hills Have Eyes still look like garbage, but that I think that's just because they didn't do any corrections to it. But
right. All right, today we're going to be talking about another horror movie, Guillermo del Toro's Crimson Peak. And at the end of the program, we're going to be reviewing Frankenstein's Army for our Netflix homework. We have a little bit of movie news here, not too much. And I'll start with the first one. This isn't speculative news like we usually do. This one's just kind of more of a special interest piece, I suppose. John Carpenter won a lawsuit over Luc Besson because of the film Lockout. Lockout was a sci-fi action film that took place in outer space, but it was essentially the exact same plot as Escape from New York.
And L.A.
Yeah, well,
because it had a lot of the similar beats to those movies, like weirdly similar scenes.
Yeah. Well, I'll just read the first paragraph here of this Variety story. It says, in a May 7 ruling made public Thursday, a Paris regional court has sided with John Carpenter and Studio Canal, finding Luc Besson and Lockout co-writers Stephen St. Ledger and James Marther guilty of having plagiarized Carpenter's Escape from New York. So it was close enough that he ended up winning about $91,000 American, which is really not that much in the world of movies. But I guess, you know, John Carpenter's ego won.
Yeah, well, I don't know. See, this is specifically a case where I'm like, well, first of all, it's in Paris, and that's questionable. The French, they're questionable people. beyond that, I guess what I really, really, I'm, where is it like okay to be an homage to something and where is it not okay? Like, because I mean, it did like have some very strange, similar beats. I'll say that.
Sure.
And it was, but I don't think that they were ever like, this isn't a knockoff, Escape from New York.
Yeah. Nobody ever claimed that it wasn't.
But that's when I get kind of like weird, because I'm like, well, then how do studios like the ones that were making those like fake Transformer movies and those kind of things, what do they even do?
Transmorphers?
Like, yeah, I think that's what it was. Yes.
Yeah. Studios like Asylum, who make the mockbusters.
Well, see, that's one thing, because I know when you're doing satire, you can take things more. You can take things more scene for scene or beat for beat.
Those were
if you're making fun of.
Most of those, they are literally just, it's, as far as I can tell, they were just making the movie similar enough, and then if they did the graphics on the DVD or the poster close enough, they were hoping they could trick people into accidentally redboxing it.
Into
thinking it was the other movie. Yeah. Or naive parents who don't know anything. Or it's like, oh, we got you the Transformers for Christmas. Like, Mom, this is Transmorphers. It's bullshit.
Yes. Exactly like that. Are you doing a scene from your childhood?
Maybe. No. I'm doing a scene from a lot of people's childhoods, I'm sure. But yeah, so I don't know. I don't really have any dog in this hunt. I never saw Lockout. You did.
It was amusing one time watch sci-fi. I don't know. I've seen a lot of these crappy movies, so I don't know what's better. Like, to me, it was less offensive than a blatant remake. So it's sort of one of those things where I'm like, I don't know about this. Like, it sort of brings up weird implications.
Right. Well, I don't think this is going to set much of a precedent, only because it was a French court. And so I think, yeah, I don't know, their free speech laws and their whatever could be slightly different, or their creative owner laws. I don't know exactly how it works over there. But had it not been made by Eurocorp, which is Luc Besson's company, that makes all the Taken movies and whatever.
Right.
I don't think it would have went down like this.
I wouldn't have won.
No.
That might be true.
No. I'm almost certain of it. Okay. What was your first story?
Oh, what was my first story? So we're going to be talking about that Thor 3 again. So it's being directed by one very strange director, Takeo Waititi.
Yeah. We announced that last week.
Yeah. Well, it was just announced just very basically after that Mark Ruffalo's The Hulk will appear in the Thor. This is interesting. I think it's funny when they interact. They beat the crap out of each other.
Sure.
You know? So,
well, this almost kind of goes along with my idea. I think I said last week, because they had hired what's his name?
I don't know if I said it right.
Waititi, the guy who directed that vampire comedy we both liked, What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah.
Because I hired him, I speculated that they might be trying to go a little bit further in a comedic direction, because I think a lot of people thought that the last one was a little too self-serious. So, the Hulk.
Also, the Avengers, those two scenes were... There are two big Hulk versus, like, an Asgardian scenes that people seem to really enjoy.
Right, yeah. I think you throw in the Hulk and you kind of bring a certain levity to it just because of what the character is and their dynamic in those movies.
Well, one of the cartoons or whatever, Loki basically does something and makes the Hulk attack Asgard just blatantly. So I'm sure there's going to be a rampaging Hulk at some time. But yeah, it could be funny. I'm sure that they're going to do... The only thing that I'm like is he just like replacing Jane Foster? Is it going to be kind of like the second one, but he's going to be, you know, the fish out of water in Asgard? Because I mean, he's got the scientist thing going on.
Maybe that's a direction they could go. I'd be into that.
I'd be halfway into that. I mean, we already kind of saw that, and so I mostly just want to see Hulk fight some Asgardians. That's all I really want.
I have a feeling like you'll probably get what you want.
Yeah, so they'll probably do
it. Although, wouldn't it be funny? Because all of the headlines for the story have just been Mark Ruffalo's been cast. What if he wasn't playing Bruce Banner or the Hulk?
That would be interesting. Like a time-traveling evil Bruce Banner that doesn't...
No, like nothing. Like he's just scientist number three.
Or he's just Mark Ruffalo.
Playing himself. Ruffalo. It gets real meta.
Yeah.
this is where the Marvel franchise starts to like jump the shark, and now they're doing like movies where they meet them, the actors who play them.
That would be weird. I don't know, I'd be into it. I've been watching so many horrible horror movies at this point. It's like, okay, sure. Why not?
All right. The last story I have here is, oh lordy, this is a little bit of a mouthful. So let me just read the first graph here. It's a Deadline story, so I'm not going to read their jokey first line. Okay, Fox is making a deal for Live Free or Die Hard helmer Len Wiseman to return and develop with producer Lorenzo Di Bonaventura. for a sixth installment of Die Hard, the venerable action series that overwrought transformed Bruce Willis's career, blah, blah, blah. All of this is early, but they are referring to this as Die Hard Year One. Yeah, now I remember. Okay, so basically this is like a reboot, a soft reboot. They're going to bring on Bruce Willis to play the main character, John McClane, and he's going to like bookend the movie with like the beginning and the end, and he's going to be recalling his first year as a police officer in L.A., and the movie will take place in like the late 70s, early 80s.
Wouldn't it be New York?
Oh, I guess it would be, yeah, because he moved from New York.
Sorry, just random.
Oh, no, you're fine. And then somebody younger is going to play his younger self.
Well, that's good. I was either picturing that or... So it's going to be like Princess Bride, but not quite, but like Die Hard style.
I guess. I think it's going to... I mean, it's like what they said, Die Hard Year One, which I hope that's just a working title, not the one they decide to go with.
I think... Because I remember on shelves there being a Die Hard, like, Year One series on the comic book shelves.
Oh, yeah, I guess that's a possibility.
Is Len Wiseman, is he the one that did the fourth one as well? I know, didn't he do, like, the Underworld series or something?
Yeah, he did the Underworld series. He did the remake of Total Recall most recently, and he did Live Free or Die Hard, which was the... fourth in the series.
Yeah, he didn't do the last one, which is real, real bad.
Yeah.
He did the fourth one where he fought a jet.
Yeah, that one.
Okay, good.
That
one was kind of enjoyable, so...
The writer he's working with was this... who I don't know if he's going to be writing the script, but he's developing the movie, is the writer of Die Hard with a Vengeance, which was originally just an action movie, a generic action movie that had no IP, and they retrofitted it to be a Die Hard sequel.
Is The Vengeance, is that the second one?
That's the third one that had Samuel L. Jackson.
That one's good. I like that
one.
Yeah,
that's a lot of people's second favorite, including myself.
Sometimes my first favorite. I really enjoy Samuel L. Jackson. Anyway, this is middling news.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, if you're going to do it, this might be a good direction to go.
Do you I just feel like, okay.
I hope they do it in like really like gaudy black leather costumes.
Right.
Fight.
I hope they make it look like a cruising or something like that. Like they make it look like it came out in 1980.
I was like, oh, go there. I guess they could do that. That would make it entertaining.
Well, you mentioned the leather, but no. I meant just like that era of action thriller.
No.
I don't know, Dirty Harry look or something like that.
That could be fun, yeah.
I don't think they will, but here I think that the issue is that you're going to have to find this actor who's going to be essentially doing a Bruce Willis impression the whole movie, and that could be extremely distracting / annoying.
They should just get not Jake Gyllenhaal, I keep doing this. Jason Gordon-Levitt and put him in the Looper makeup.
Right, a lot of people have made that exact joke on there.
It could make they have been? That's good. That's it's pretty obvious, I guess.
Right, yeah.
But if they do it, they should do it as a sequel to Looper as well.
It all ties in together.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, well, I think that's our movie news.
I suppose.
Not a lot else that's worth talking about, so we can go ahead and get into the reviews. And I'll let you set up Crimson Peak.
Okay. Crimson Peak is Guillermo del Toro's latest movie. What's kind of different about this one for being an English language made films is he tries to do a more adult and serious film with it. It stars Mia Wasikowska, Jessica Chastain, Tom Hiddleston, and Charlie Hunnam. Also some like fun little parts by Jim Beaver and Bern Gorman.
It's a lot of people who's we've seen in other movies by him.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim Beaver, I think most people, he was the alcoholic dude in, that's not a good way to say it. He was in Deadwood and in Supernatural a lot. Anyway, this is Guillermo del Toro's take on the Victorian romance kind of creepy, spooky
gothic horror.
Yeah. And it comes across exactly like that. It's if you've seen any Vincent Price movies or read any of these books, it is dead on that. He doesn't try to, it's not like a joke. It's not like he really tries to take on that that genre and that look and that feel. Mm-hmm. Now, the movie itself follows the character played by Mia, Edith Cushing. It follows her in kind of this, like, swept away by a swarthy, dark European man played by Tom Hiddleston, mm-hmm. who has a kind of bitchy, glaring sister played by Jessica Chastain. And father gets murdered and there's ghosts creeping about and saying things. And the set's beautiful. I mean, really, really, it's a very classically made movie. I don't, if you've seen any of those and you've liked them, I think you'll like this movie. Because it has a very old time feel to it. Maybe a little more modern because it definitely goes there in violence and in, some content.
Yeah.
But I feel like it has a very, like, old time, or not old time, like more classical movie timing. Like,
right. Very pacing. Earnest.
Well, it's
not like going for like, you know, a raised eyebrow kind of irony or anything like that.
Right. Well, but even the pacing is like an older film. Like, it's not like it's not a quick, like, snap, 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 snap kind of film. It kind of meanders at parts. And I think in a good way. I enjoyed it just for that because it felt like watching like an older movie, like a classic movie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how else did I feel about this? I know I felt other things.
Do you want me to start?
Yeah, jump in right now.
Okay. Yes, I agree with you that he's definitely throwing his hat in the ring of the sort of Victorian 19th century gothic romance / gothic horror genre. And a long time ago, a few years ago, Guillermo del Toro was supposed to be making a haunted castle or haunted mansion movie for Disney. That was one of the many projects that he was attached to at one point and became unattached. And I have a feeling like a lot of what we're seeing here was originally conceived for that. And he probably kept the stuff that he liked and was able to, with Legendary, recreate the story in his own way.
At least some of the house stuff I could see.
Right, yeah.
I was just thinking about the content a little, and I was like, I don't know if Disney would go for that.
No,
I know what you're saying.
I mean, the genre, the look, maybe some of the production design, that kind of stuff.
I think his other version would be a little more fun, but
yeah, it probably would have moved a little faster and probably would have been a little less intense.
Well, I think it would be a little more like poppy, like his Hellboy and
Sure.
and those kind of films.
Sure. There's still, I think, a germ of that in here, though.
Sure.
And so, yeah, it's a little bit of that. It feels a little bit like a Hammer movie sometimes.
Well, a lot of those are essentially gothic romance.
Yeah, gothic horror and gothic romance, but played with a little bit of exploitation flair.
Well, that's what's interesting about this is there are scenes, like, I feel like it has more of like a classic, like, if you're going to do a Jane Eyre movie or something like that, just because he does it so well. But you also get these moments where it's like, there's a moment in a bathroom where a scene happens. And if you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
It becomes a slasher flick. Like, literally, like, the beat and the pace and everything is like, this is a slasher movie. And you wouldn't see that from a lot of other directors because they don't take it seriously. But he does. So for me, that was interesting. There's also a bit of, like, I would say Giallo and sister movement, the Spanish horror kind of, you'll see little things from those kind of films in this as well. I feel like, anyway.
Yeah. I mean, the movie's very referential in general. There's shades of a lot of these kind of horror movies that kind of run in this genre. I felt, you know, there's scenes that, were lifted almost directly from The Changeling. The bathtub scene to me felt very much like the same setup as The Shining. There's a lot of Rebecca in here, the Hitchcock film.
A lot of people have been saying that. I haven't seen Rebecca, so I can't comment.
Oh, well, you should. It's horror enough. I think you could fit it in your thing.
Okay.
Maybe it will. I don't know how it all comes together ultimately. I think that it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. If anything, you can say one thing with a Guillermo del Toro film is that he knows production design. Mm-hmm. And I almost feel like the production design in this movie is a little overwhelming. I think it's a little overlit a lot of the times. I feel like his you know, crazy arches and the doors and stuff and, you know, the walls that are constantly bleeding, this red clay that's made to look like blood. which plays heavily into the themes of the movie as well. There's a lot of this stuff, and it seems so concerned with production design that I feel like it swallows up the story a lot of the time. And it tonally feels strange because there are these scenes of extreme violence that happen about every 15, 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Especially towards the last third, it kind of goes like totally crazy.
Well, I kind of wonder if this is kind of like when people see a Korean movie, not in Korean, like a Stoker. Because I know of people who also have this feeling about this movie. But to me, I don't know, just because I can hear the language mm-hmm. in some of his other films. Like, it plays very similar to me as, like, the Devil's Backbone in a lot of ways.
Right. When there's specific production stuff that he took from that and brought into this, and even a little bit from Pan's Labyrinth, I don't think it has any of the finesse that those movies have, though. Those movies, yes, are big and operatic and very kind of base fairy tale kind of storytelling mm-hmm. motifs, and he's bringing that sort of thing here. But to me, it something about it feels, for lack of a better word, hokey a lot of the times. It felt a lot like to me, I felt like I was watching a Harry Potter film, and then every once in a while something extreme would happen.
See, and that's why I thought it was a language thing, because you have that separation,
right? However, I've seen his other
and
movies.
That cultural. You've seen his other movies, but tons of people have seen Korean movies and been fine with them, and then they watch something like Snowpiercer, and because the language does a very specific thing, when Chris Evans says, "I'm going to eat a baby," even though that's referential to something, like people, it's hard to take seriously. And I'm not saying that as a criticism or an argument really that much. I'm just saying, I don't know.
I enjoyed this movie. Something gets lost in the translation, but I don't see it as a failing on my part to.
I don't think this is as good, but as those other films.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's probably as good as Kronos, if not a little better.
I would disagree with that.
That's fine. Whatever. But what I'm saying is that I think that this film, I think it's a little bit people's expectations. I think it does exactly what it's trying to be, and I think it has some rich thematics and some other things that are happening in it that I do think that are pretty good. I think the film is very interested in the wealth dynamics and of its characters. And I don't think this is as good as his last two more serious films. I really don't, in earnest, but I do think that it's better than some people say, but not as good. I feel like it's being a little bit maligned by people.
Right. I don't hate it. I wouldn't advise someone against seeing it. I just think the overall effect of the movie is not that effective. I think that as a horror film, it's not that scary.
I don't think it's trying to be a straight up horror film. There is a difference between, because he doesn't even like try to eschew the fact that he goes, "No, I'm making more of a Victorian romance," which is different from
sure, but he has horror. He has horror movie setups that he's been trying to build tension, and I can see those scenes, like you said, they're the slasher scenes or whatever. The scenes with the ghosts. There's a lot of scenes where he's trying to build tension, and I'm not feeling it at all. And I think a lot of that is because it is too overlit. It is too operatic. It's a little too big, and I think it.
But I don't think that that's its intention to be that, because that's a lot of times what we talk about with films is what is.
You don't think that there are scenes that he designed specifically?
I just did say that some of his scenes are designed that way, but I didn't say the overall movie isn't designed to be that way.
Right.
Which is a different take. Now, I do think that it doesn't. There is something that plays out sort of strange. I will agree with one of our friends. It's hard to take. I think Shirley Uman did a fine job in the movie. But mm-hmm. for some reason, the way he covers his accent and the way that he just talks, right. I can't buy him as a doctor.
No. I mean,
I don't think he did a bad job. I think he's a decent actor.
It's sort of a thankless role. Like, there's not a lot
that's true,
there too. For him to do anyway. Like, he's kind of just, he's very, like, kind of a, you know, if we're talking about Victorian literature, he's very kind of a Heathcliff type character.
Yeah.
So he's just supposed to be sort of like handsome and brooding and whatever. But yeah, well, I wasn't feeling a whole lot from him. But I mean, there's specific decisions in the movie that I felt like were just not very good decisions. I think having Jessica Chastain from the first scene we ever see her be clearly not on the up and up. I think that really kills a lot of the tension throughout the movie as we're supposed to learn more and more about her character and more about this overall plot that's going and how she's integrated into it. I feel like had we not known, you know, directly, had she not been playing it so broad immediately, I think that Guillermo del Toro blows his monster load too early. From the very first scene, we see a ghost.
See, and I don't think so, because those ghosts aren't really, I mean, throughout the whole thing, those are just thematic. They're not even, the wording on this is going to get tricky. The ghosts are like the ghosts in some of his other films.
Yes.
I think that the one in Devil's Backbone is used more, yes, is used more effectively. However, I think they're fine. I actually, where I was kind of like, okay, whatever. Is he'll push the boundary of violence in this movie.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's necessarily needed completely, but at the same time, I felt like for it trying to be more sensual and sexual, I felt like it was a little weak still. Like if you're going to go there with that stuff, then push that stuff.
Right.
Make it a little bit more visceral. Those were the things that I felt like kind of, weren't as impactful, especially compared to some of the violence in it.
It's like he kind of detracted from one to give to the other.
Well, I think that sort of. I don't think it's as effective as some of his other ones, and I don't, maybe that is from him working in English. But I think it's still a pretty decent movie. I think it's worth your watch, and I also think it's worth. Especially if you like some of these type of films, mm-hmm. like I think this is very much easily watchable and very much into it. Some of yours, I just don't really feel like it's really maybe the overall effect of everything you're saying maybe detracted from your viewing, but I don't think in general it's really going to detract many people. I think the overall aesthetics are beautiful and are part of the ride.
No, see, that's the thing, is I know that everyone's going to immediately defend the production design because the movie's designed within an inch of its life. I think that's the first takeaway from the movie is how beautiful it looks and how much money went into how it looks. I feel like it doesn't come off so much as interesting and daring and whatever, as it just comes off as expensive and slick. And I've seen him use his production design and his, you know, thing with a tonal balance that makes up for how overwhelming that could be. And here I felt like the production design was driving the movie. And I felt like it kind of ultimately felt a little bit like a theme park ride. It didn't. The plot was so traditional that it didn't really do much for me ultimately.
I liked it. I think that it is one of his serious stuff. It's more of a middling one, mm-hmm. If we're talking about its overall effects. But I don't. I feel like people have to go to the sides on whatever their like opinions on the film is, but I think the film is pretty it's a good movie. It's just not his best, and that's okay.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I was a little bored. I'm not gonna lie.
That's okay.
I can't come away with it with even comfortably calling it a good movie because there's so long stretches of the movie where I felt like. Get on with it already because I kind of saw where it was going pretty early on.
I felt that too, but I still liked when it came to the point and what happened and how it played out. I still enjoyed it. And I still enjoyed just the overall, I enjoyed the ride of the film. Mm-hmm. But I think more films are like that than we let on. This film specifically, I think you have to be into it. I did get a little bored with the lovey-dovey stuff because I knew, I think they might have spent too much time on that part. Because you already knew that was going to happen. Like, I mean, that's in the previews. It's just
right
how a lot of that's how this plays out. So I feel like there could have been more time spent in other places to maybe a better effect. I don't know. But I think overall, lots of good performances. People saying that the production of it is very good. They're right. If you're into, I'm not saying you personally, I'm using mm-hmm. the you as in the, you know, the bigger you.
Right.
I think that you, if you're not into like a slower paced film, this does have a very deliberate and older pacing, like an older film would. And
yeah,
I think that's going to draw some people away, and I'm okay with that. I think it's worth some people's time, and but it's not, I don't know.
That could have been why actually the movie looks the way it does, and why it's so bright and so, for lack of a better description, Haunted Mansion-esque, mm-hmm. is because they knew that the story was a little slower of a burn, and there was a lot of reveals to get to. And I thought maybe he made it look the way he did so that you would at least have something to look at while you're waiting. Mm. I still think the storytelling is just so conventional, and that it, to me, it just felt a little plotting. I don't think anyone's really stand out.
The plot was whatever. Yeah, the plot was like any of those kind of movies plot. I thought the thematics were interesting again.
Yeah,
I think it definitely is talking about wealth distribution, and especially how, gosh, this gets tricky because of how it plays out. I don't know. I'm just going into spoiler zone. This is the official spoiler zone. To me, the thematics of this movie is a lot about the wealth. And so specifically, we're talking about Mia Wachowski comes from this more wealthy family.
Yeah.
And they have this, you know, they went into great length to describe that Tom Hiddleston comes also from a formerly wealthy family.
Yeah.
From Europe. And it's very much he's a baroness or baronet, something like that. Anyways, they basically say, you know, they make this joke about his character being like, well, what your character really does is make, you know, his living off the living of other people.
Right.
And so I very much saw it as kind of like the thematics were about how older money, how it swallows up newer money and kind of makes it part of the old system or the new system. Kind of, I guess, almost in a Marxian sort of way. And so I found that interesting. The plot, however, is a pretty stock plot from this type of film.
Right.
So it depends on if you can just get behind the aesthetics and the thematics and stuff like that. I think it's worth your time. I wouldn't say that it's, again, it's not his best film, but I think it's a pretty decent ride. I don't know now if we're still also talking like good, bad. Repeatability factor, I would go back to it to kind of, because I feel like I did miss some things. I would go back to it, but I think you're right. The slowness of it would keep me away for a little bit. It's not something I could go back to immediately.
Right. It wasn't even necessarily a matter of slow. Like, mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of movies that I really like that are super slow. The Shining is glacial. But it's more just a matter of not interesting as it's going along. And, I don't know. It just didn't really hold my attention.
That's okay.
I like the last act when it kind of goes a little more cuckoo bananas. Then I was at least enjoying it more on a visceral level.
Okay.
That's sort of my overall impressions of it. I wasn't as big of a fan of Pacific Rim as a lot of people were, or, you know, the people who managed to see it anyway. But I even think that has more, you know, just big robot action fun in it. And well, it at least seems to be having a little bit more fun with its premise than this movie does.
Fun with the premise, I'll get that. But I think other than that, it's kind of apples and oranges. What?
Right.
Like, I mean, you're talking about what Guillermo del Toro is doing, but even in those, he's trying to accomplish two very different things with these
films.
I'm
just saying, both movies are very kind of slick and expensive and kind of Hollywood features. And within their genres, I feel like Pacific Rim accomplishes more what it's trying to do than I feel like this one does within its genre.
Okay.
But yeah, I don't know. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and get into the Netflix homework.
Okay.
Which you assigned me last week. Frankenstein's Army. And you had heard this from a friend of a friend, or?
No, from a friend.
Oh, yes. It was John Bender.
Yeah.
And this came out in 2013, and it's a low-budget, sort of found footage film. I mean, it is a found footage film, but it's not shot on video or digital. It's, well, it is, but it's made to look as if it's shot on, like, I don't know, 18mm from 1940-something.
Mm-hmm.
The basic plot is there is a team of Russian soldiers who are moving into Eastern Germany towards the end of World War II, and they uncover a big Nazi plot to build essentially zombie Frankenstein steampunk robots.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And that's the movie.
Yeah, talking about a ride of a movie, this is literally just a ride. But I don't think that that's a bad thing. I actually like this movie.
Yeah.
It's dumb fun. It's dumb gory fun. You have to be, I think, kind of... I think you have to like these kind of films to go
for. Have a high tolerance for schlock?
Yes. But, I mean, certainly if you do, though, this, I think this is a fun, like, little film.
Right.
And I do like a lot of the production, like the steampunk Frankenstein stuff. Some of those are pretty rad. I think that they were, I mean, for its budget, I think that's pretty cool that they went that far with it.
Yeah, and the fact that for the most part, it's all practical.
Mm-hmm.
It's all makeup effect and, you know, these contraptions that they build on these people, these actors, and a lot of, you know, again, talking about production design made to, you know, kind of look like a rusty, thing. Is it weird that I thought a lot about, that David Ayer movie from last year, Fury, but with zombies? Cause no. I mean, it's just one of those kind of movies as far as the story goes, like a team that's entering into enemy territory. I mean, there's a lot of movies, ensemble, war movies that kind of play in, like this. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I thought a lot about that movie. Maybe it was also because that movie was super violent.
Right.
I'm kind of with you. I can't defend it as calling it a good movie. It just isn't, but it's kind of schlocky fun, and it
I would defend it as a good movie for schlocky fun.
Right. I mean in the sense of, you know, is it really defendable as on a storytelling basis? And my only beef with it, though, given that I had fun in all of its ridiculousness,
sure,
is I don't think it needed the found footage thing. It felt a little too much like a video game a lot of the times.
And see, I was okay with that because it essentially was.
Yeah, it was a horror survival game come to life.
When I see, and people use that as a pejorative a lot, the video game thing. But yeah. There are a lot of movies that's like the goal. And with this one specifically, like, this isn't an art film. We don't even need to pretend. We can just throw that out. It's not even like a John Carpenter film.
No.
You know, this is B-schlock stuff.
Yeah, it's not about anything.
But it is a good B-schlock stuff, if you like B-schlock stuff. I enjoyed it. I liked the premise. I actually think that the shooting, kind of the way that they shot it, because they wanted to make it look like an older film, I think what it did is it added to, like, the production value. Because what you're doing is it's tricking your brain into thinking that these costumes are older than they do. Because if they did it with just a slick digital camera and they just shot it straight up, it would take away from the look of a lot of these things.
No, you're definitely right there. It's really, really color corrected. And I'm sure, like, a lot of those, like, fields and stuff they were on that looked all gray and muddy and depressing were probably green and pastoral in real life.
Well, even, like, if you think about the characters and their little Russian outfits, I think that those would look too new and too
movie.
Vibrant.
Yeah.
And I mean, the funny thing about that is probably at the time when they were marching and doing stuff, it probably did look like it did through a digital lens. Mm-hmm. It's just, you have to trick our brain to tell us, oh, this is an older film. because we're talking about an older era with older technology.
Yeah.
So I actually thought that that was a very smart choice. And so I didn't mind the found footage aspect of this one specifically. And I don't, I can say, you know, a lot of found footage to me is kind of like, oh, this is silly. But I liked this one. And I think this was a fun, dumb ride. Is it a B movie to the billionth degree? Yes. But if you like that, you want to see some gore effects with some giant Frankenstein monsters during World War II with Nazi Dr. Frankenstein making, you know, his creations. Fucking watch the shit out of this. It's so fun. Like, I mean, there's not a lot to talk about other than we just said.
Right.
That's that's what you get out of it.
This is one of those it is what it is kind of reviews.
Yeah.
It is as exciting as the title Frankenstein's Army sounds to you.
Yeah.
If you don't immediately roll your eyes and run the other direction from the title Frankenstein's Army, you might like this.
You probably will. I actually think if we are comparing it to other schlock stuff,
yeah,
especially schlock stuff that comes out right now, I think it's a higher degree of B movie schlock stuff.
Well, I mean, it certainly has a little bit more creativity to it, especially in the design of it, the creature designs. You can tell, like, some hardcore makeup horror fans got involved with this and really got to play around.
Well, I would say even with the found footage aspect, I think that it really, even though it's ridiculous because they couldn't, like, do that with cameras back then, some of the shots that they
could shoot. I think a camera back then could maybe shoot like 8 minutes of footage at a time.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, but beyond that too, like the thing about it is, even though those things are totally ridiculous, I still kind of was into the, it was engaging and it took me from one end to the next. And that's all it really needs to do. There weren't a lot of dragging marks on it. Sure, you roll your eyes, you laugh, you whatever, you're supposed to. I think this, if you like B movies, this is B horror schlock. This just, you should watch it. It's good.
Right. I'm maybe not as excited about it as I was
into it for what it was.
I enjoyed it on a big dumb movie kind of level.
I probably would enjoy it more as a video game.
See, yeah, well, the only reason I really complain about the found footage thing isn't just that it's a cliche. I mean, it's that as well. But a lot of these movies that I see that are found footage and don't need to be, like David Ayer's other movie, End of Watch, I feel like you take away from the cinematic capabilities of what you can do. Like, you immediately limit yourself to certain kinds of setups, certain kinds of shots, and you can never break out of that. And there's actually, the production here is good enough that had they been able to cut away or use angles and those kind of things, some of these scenes could have played a little better, even in a B movie.
Well, your argument, I agree with your argument completely, just not for this movie. I think it works for this movie. I think it's just fine what it is. But if we're talking about other found footage, yeah, I think a lot of times it's misused and not really to like a good effect. Again, I think that the premise, because it builds into the premise, I think it kind of like makes a modicum of sense for what kind of movie it is. And it just, I think it makes it kind of like, it's kind of like going through the movie version of a haunted house.
Yeah.
And I definitely sort of enjoyed that appeal for it, because again, this is a ride of a film and that's all it is. But that's okay. That's exactly what I want from this experience. And I got it. So it was like a haunted house. I relished in their makeup ability. I thought it was cool. Yeah.
Yeah, the makeup effects, it kind of reminded me of like a little bit of like maybe like the Hellraiser 2 and 3 stuff.
Yeah.
Like when it got real weird. Or like mixed with like, I don't know, probably like some video games I've seen. I can't name specifics, but
probably like BioShock.
Yeah, like BioShock and what was Dead Space and those kind of things.
Yeah, one that they just released not too long ago, The Evil Within, kind of reminded me of too. I don't use it as a pejorative. It is like the movie is sort of like a video game, but I think that that's okay. I think that's a good thing.
Right. Well, it's not trying to be a whole lot, you know, it's a little bit more about just taking a premise and then, you know, going as far with it as you can.
Yeah, just drink some beers, sit back, watch some gore. Good. There's no boobies in this, though. I will say that.
No, actually, I will say there was a scene that I thought was a little unnecessary, even, you know, given the type of movie it is.
I don't even have to even hear what it is. You're just wrong.
Well, no, there's a scene where a female German is kind of like slapped around and beat around for pretty much no reason, as far as I can tell. It was a little cringy.
Yeah, that character was horrible in general. Right. I don't know. That character we're talking, I have a hard time, like, it was what it was. I kind of wanted, I think I needed a little, if I could ask anything, it would be a little bit more of kind of like the Evil Dead splat blood kind of, I needed a little more.
More, just more buckets of blood.
Well, I like it when, if they're gonna do this schlocky, to me it's like, go all the way. Just fucking pour it.
They go pretty far.
they do, but I mean, but I like the ridiculous, where you know it's not real.
Right.
Like, I'm not even, I'm saying at an aesthetic level. I'm not talking about, like, whatever.
Right, well,
I'm talking specifically...
It's goofy, and I don't think it's necessarily going for camp gore. I think it's...
With those big-ass robots, and they made a wrong choice.
Well, yeah, and that's what I'm saying, is I think that it's fun regardless.
Yeah.
But I do think that the people who made it thought they were making something a little more serious than what you're asking for. Because you're asking for, like, something more along the lines of, like, a hobo with a shotgun type of thing. Which is a little bit more knowing.
I didn't want them to know. I just wanted them to, you know, when they kill somebody, just splatter blood everywhere.
Just go for it.
Just buckets of blood should be used in these. And they might have been. Maybe it was expensive. Maybe you could have put a little less metal. Well, I don't know.
All right. Well, next week, I'm going to assign us for the Netflix homework, the Iranian vampire film, A Girl Who Walks Home Alone at Night, which has been on Netflix for a long time. I specifically was saving it for this month.
So it's like a thriller, horror, western.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like a little bit of a spaghetti western. It's supposed to be like a little bit of like a feminist allegory. I don't know. I've just seen the trailers and it looks super cool. I don't know what it is, really.
Looks like Cool Guide?
Yeah. Like it, yeah. It looks a little, like from the trailers, it looks a little bit like Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man, but with a vampire in it, in Iran.
Okay. I can see.
Okay, and that's the show. If anybody has anything they want to say about anything we've talked about today, if you have an opinion about Crimson Peak that may differ from ours, or Frankenstein's Army, if you happen to catch it, or Girl Who Walks Home Alone at Night, which we'll be talking about next week, or any of our news items, you can contact us at our email at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. We post all of the news stories there, some of which we don't talk about on the show, and we also like pose questions to listeners and da-da-da. We're also available on Twitter at JabberPodcast, all one word. And that's where I've been communicating a lot with the other podcasts that are sort of in our podcast family. We are listenable on iTunes and Stitcher. And now we are on... Oh, shit. I forgot what it's called.
Is it like Last FM? No, it's not Last FM. Something like that.
It's called Player FM.
Okay, yeah. I knew there was something to do with that.
Yeah, we are now available to listen on Player FM. So if that is your preferred podcatcher, go ahead and listen to us there. And if you're on Stitcher or iTunes, please leave us a star rating and a one-sentence review. It would really help us a lot as far as getting other people to notice us and see us on those sites. I have other stuff.
Oh, stuff.
We are also on the Zune and Windows Podcast Network, as well as Pocket Cast. You can read my movie reviews that I write weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can see some of the articles and reviews I've written for the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Richard has a blog that he may or may not ever write on again called rdwally.weebly.com.
Yeah, that's the riveting part. Is he going to write on it, or isn't he going to write on it?
You never know.
You probably
and,
do.
We have a lot of friends out there who also have podcasts, and I will list those. Brad, Amanda, and Alyssa do a podcast called Quarter Life Crisis. About as about as frequently as you write on your blog at quartercrisis.podbean.com.
So they don't do it? It's not a podcast anymore? Is that what you're saying?
They do it in bursts. It fits and starts. They'll like release four in like a week, and then you won't hear from them again in like 2 months. And then release another four.
That's more than me.
Right. Be sure to listen to our friend Leland over from Olympia, Washington at dampercast.com. Now, he released like four a week. So it's almost so much you can't keep up. Our friend Patrick over in Detroit at Make Dad Read Comics and his other podcast, which we're going to be guesting on here pretty soon. Almost
Educational. On the 25th of this month.
So Almost Educational. Check us out on there. We'll let you know when we're on. Probably either on Twitter and Facebook, which is another reason why you should be following us there. And I've also been invited to guest on the music podcast, The Listening Party, which tapes here in Los Angeles. So I'll be taping in studio, I think, in November. And then I think it's going to be the first episode of December.
Ooh.
So we'll see how that goes. Until then, we'll talk to you next week. And hopefully we'll be feeling a lot better.
No, let's just keep doing it. I think this is good. I think we should do this like every week.
Just purposely make ourselves sick.